The Food Book Fair is a multi-day festival where the nation's best authors, farmers, chefs, artists, publishers, and food enthusiasts gathered in Williamsburg for the second year to celebrate literary food culture. On Friday, Michael Harlan Turkell of HeritageRadioNetwork.org talked food roots, both literally and figuratively. Bonnie Wolf, Dominica Marchetta, and Michelle Kale are the ladies of AmericanFoodRoots.com, a new website celebrating the history and diversity of American food. We caught up with them after their panel on how the stories behind our food can broaden our understanding of who we are as individuals and as Americans.
This is Michael Harlan Turkell reporting for HeritageRadioNetwork.org at the Food Book Fair here today with American Food Roots, the ladies of Bonnie Wolf, Michelle Kale, and Domenica Marchetti. Thank you for being here. So excited because we work in a very like-minded fashion. What we do at Heritage is trying to bring a voice or a story out that normally isn't told of, you know, our food past, present, and future. And I think you do the same. Who wants to take the mic and explain a little bit about the impetus and the future of American Food Roots?
Hi, this is Bonnie Wolf, and I'm the managing editor of AmericanFoodRoots.com. And as you said, we are very like-minded. We are, you said we were brethren. I think we're a sisterhood to your, you can be our brother. But we do have a very, very similar mission. We started as a way to tell America's food stories, to tell the sort of the stories behind the recipes that we're all familiar with. We sort of think of ourselves as the story, as StoryCorps meets James Beard. We tell people stories, but in a very with a very American bent, and we tell the story of we're sort of about the why of food rather than the what or the where or the how. We try to help explain why we eat what we eat. And we do it with a variety of features that we refresh every day, every other day. And we try to get voices from across the country to represent different regions, different ethnicities, different religions, different historical practices. And that's sort of what we're all about.
You know, I find it very interesting that you say you're trying to bring this food story forward. But why? Why food for you? You come from such interesting and diverse backgrounds, and you talk about religious, you talk about ethnic. Can you tell me a little bit about how you were raised in food and why it's so important to you?
Hi, this is Domenica. As you can tell by my name, I was raised in an Irish family. in an Italian American home, food is love, and so I had plenty of love on my plate as I was growing up. But so I think what is important is that we all come from somewhere and we feel very connected to these places. I mean, I was born in New York and raised in New Jersey, but I spent a lot of my time in Italy in the summer when I was growing up in the Abruzzo region of Italy. And I feel very connected to this place. I try to get back as often as I can. I write cookbooks, and the cuisine of that region is always in my food, in my cooking, in my recipes somehow. I think that people just yearn to belong and feel connected to place. There are a lot of young Italian Americans who have actually gone back to Italy and, you know, looking for their roots. And I think that it's something that we all seek. And so when I'm cooking for my kids, I sort of feel like I'm giving them something of their heritage.
Hi, this is Michelle Kale. Domenica grew up in a sort of first generation Italian, and I'm a bit more removed from that. My grandparents came from Aleppo in Syria. And throughout my growing up, I remember going to my grandmother's in Brooklyn on Sundays And you could tell the minute you walked through the door of the apartment building what was for dinner. And the thing is that food and that connection to that food is the only connection I have left to that culture. My grandparents are gone. I grew up on Long Island. And, you know, and I think, you know, in this age of internet and everything else, this is what reminds you of who you are and where you came from and that you're not just in the now. And I think that's a story that so many Americans can relate to, whether it's an ethnic story like ours or whether it's the story of, you know, the sugar cream pie you grew up with in Indiana or these things that are just so ingrained in you and that can cause back who you are at your essence at just the sight of it.
Hi, this is Bonnie again. And everybody eats, and they usually don't eat just for fuel. You connect with your friends, with your family, with ancestors you never knew through the foods that you eat and you serve. And as Domenica says, food is a real expression of love often. So everyone has a warm feeling about the recipes, the foods they grow up with, their favorite recipes from their grandmothers. And it's, I guess, this commonality and the passion everyone feels. Every time we ask somebody for a story about the foods they grew up with, they get a smile on their face, and it's just a very, very human reaction to an everyday event.
So, the word American in American Food Roots obviously represents a national look at a lot of these heritage that come here and made it their own. When did American Food Roots really begin here in the U.S.? How far back are you exploring?
This is Bonnie. It goes back to before the beginning, before the creation. There was food. Certainly before there was the United States, there were Native Americans who lived here who grew corn and squash and all sorts of things that they gave to the colonists who didn't want them and went through the starving days, is that what they were called? And then the colonists came and brought their own food ways and foods. They brought livestock that wasn't here before. They brought seeds that weren't here before. So it goes back very, very far, I mean, before recorded history on the actual land. And then every group who has come afterwards has added ingredients to the stew.
We go back. Oh, this is Michelle. And one of the cool things that we've discovered is that every time you go back, you discover something about American history or American culture that you didn't know. We did a story maybe a month or so ago that was going to be a really simple story. I mean, they always start out that way, right? It's like an onion. And it was just their Mars Candy Company is doing a heritage chocolate. And they've tried to reproduce as closely as possible the chocolate that would have been eaten by colonists, which, of course, was not a chocolate bar, but hot chocolate, because there was no way at that point to form it into bars. And so what started out as this story about this spiced chocolate or whatever devolved into a discovery that the first mill on the first river in America that became the hub of the Industrial Revolution here had a chocolate mill on it. That mill was a chocolate mill. And also that drinking hot chocolate became this act of patriotism because it was a beverage that wasn't taxed. Coffee was taxed. Tea was taxed. So to drink hot chocolate, which somehow they had overlooked because it was coming through the Caribbean and all of that and wasn't taxed, that was an act of early patriotism.
So three C words that were brought to my attention while you were talking are culture, cultivate, and culinary. In what order do you think those things happen for most of these foods?
Culture, cultivate, culinary. I'm going to say that almost everyone's first experience will be culinary, simply because even if you're 5 years old, you're experiencing it as a culinary event rather than as a cultural event. You don't realize you're in a culture when you're five. When I started working for the Associated Press, I freelanced for the Associated Press, and my first experience with them was my editor called and said to me, "Do you know anything about hummus?" And I laughed. I was like, "Well, I've been making it since I was about 4 years old. yeah, what do you want to know? And but I had never interpreted it other than this thing I really like to eat. And I think that, so your first interaction is always going to be at the very animal level of eating it. And when you say culinary, I'm not interpreting that as, you know, an art, from an artistic culinary point of view, just a purely palate point. There's an alliteration.
I agree. I think that either, this is Bonnie, either culture or culinary could come first. The cultivation comes much later. I mean, people do not, what we've gone back to now. They foraged, they hunted, they didn't grow things to eat necessarily. Things grew and they ate them, and then they learned to cultivate them. And different groups came in and brought different animals and different seeds, and they learned to cultivate them. But they experienced them first in an unadulterated, very local form.
Yes, I wanted to say something about the culinary aspect, culinary / culture. And this makes me think of a piece that I wrote back in December. I guess we decided I was going to do a little piece on the Feast of Seven Fishes, I guess, because I'm the Italian one among us.
She's our senior Italian.
Yeah, senior and only Italian correspondent. But well, so I thought, oh my God, how boring is that? I eat this meal every Christmas, you know, for the last 40 plus years, I've been eating seafood on Christmas Eve. I guess I'll crank something out. Well, it turns out that this story really hit a nerve with people, because what I said was, and this, you know, I went to my mother and I said, okay, we've been eating calamari and bacala and all of this stuff every Christmas Eve for decades, and I've never heard it called the Feast of Seven Fishes. And my mother said, doesn't exist, non esiste, in Italy. She said, there's no such thing as the Feast of Seven Fishes. That's an American thing, an Italian-American thing. And my mother, who was born and raised in Abruzzo and came over in the 1950s, has always had a big line of separation between Italian and Italian-American, and she's on the Italian side. So I wrote a piece on how the Feast of Seven Fishes is really more of an American thing than an Italian-American thing. And boy, did we get some comments about that. I mean, from people saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Why don't you check your facts before you write stories? My family has been, you know, celebrating the Feast of Seven Fishes for many years. My family's from outside of Naples. My family's from Calabria. And then we started getting responses in Italian from people in Italy saying, I grew up in Italy and I've never heard of the Feast of Seven Fishes. And so it really, these stories, their cultural context really strikes a chord with people.
Sources. Because I love that you went to your mother to verify whether or not this was true. And of course she's going to say, no, I've never heard of this, but she probably has. Who are the sources and how do you parlay or relay that information?
Well, we're reporters, so we get a number of sources. Domenica did not. Well, maybe for that piece, you did just go to your mother because
no,
it was.
I talked to others as well, and.
But for a commentary, you could. But for most of our stories are pretty deeply reported, and we have a strict rule against Wikipedia, and
we do.
Yeah. Oh, no. And we go to sources that we've developed. We know how to report a story. We go to government sources, industry sources. We talk to more than one person to get more than, okay, everybody's raising their hands now. So who wants to tell me I'm wrong first?
Okay. I'm not going to tell you you're wrong at all. I'm going to elaborate and say that I think that's why we occupy a unique space as well, because we are seasoned, longtime journalists, and we approach even this internet format from that point of view. Not that there's anything wrong with blogs, but we bristle at being called a blog because we are more of an online magazine or something like that. And we're trying to hit that sweet spot between very well-sourced pieces and pieces that connect with you on a gut level. So you can be well-sourced and still, catch someone's cultural interest, emotional interest, taste interest, And I think we do that. I'm just going to briefly say that I wrote a piece about West Virginia and how it's, and that was a sourced piece where I went and had dinner with a family there and then the history behind it. But really sort of bringing in the fact that I ate squirrel for dinner and all of this. So you're hitting people at a sensory level. And yet behind all of that is a very well-reported solid foundation.
But I also want to say that our community is extremely important. I mean, we have these well-reported stories, but a lot of what we find out comes from our readers themselves in the comments or the people who are in our community. For example, I love Chinese food and Asian food, and my daughter loves to cook Asian food. And a while back, we got a wok, and it's developed a beautiful patina over the years. And so I took a picture of it and posted it on my Facebook page, and I tagged the cookbook author Grace Young in it. And I said this would be a patina that Grace Young would, you know, I think would approve of. Well, she commented, and, you know, so this thread started on my Facebook page, and one of our community members commented saying how she had started to use her wok to make her Italian Italian sausage and peppers and other like traditional classic Italian dishes. And so I glommed onto her and I was like, you are writing a piece about this for American Food Roots. And so so she did. She wrote a lovely essay called My Italian Wok. And you know, it goes into family and food, and it's just a lovely, evocative piece. But that is something that comes from one person's heart and soul. And so those stories, to me, are just as important. And there are millions of stories like that all over the country.
So I was going to ask you the question, who's your audience? But I think it's actually turned into who's your audience slash contributors, because it seems as if you want this to be an interactive forum.
Yes.
Absolutely. We're really excited about our community. We have a community now of a few hundred, and we've started, and Domenica can tell you about this, we've started a community kitchen feature. We get such thoughtful, interesting comments from our community that a number of them develop into stories, and we really want to do much, much more with our community.
Yeah, so Community Kitchen is an occasional series that we run on the website. And it's basically somebody from our community who either writes a piece for us or you know, we interview. And mainly we have found stories by reading the bios of our community members. And, you know, we ask them in their bios, you know, favorite family recipe, favorite food memory. And so many people have taken the time to write incredible stories. There was one young woman who just recently wrote a community kitchen piece for us called Pound Cake in Prayers. And it's about how she learned how to make the perfect pound cake from her grandmother. And her grandmother passed away. And so, you know, for her, it's a very kind of meditative activity. And she thinks, you know, and kind of channels her grandmother in the kitchen when she's making this pound cake. So there are so many stories that people are wanting to share about how food is central to their lives, their families, their memories. And so that's why we created Community Kitchen.
We have another feature that we really love the community to interact with, and that's called My American Roots. These are 2-minute video food memoirs. And we've had a number of wonderful ones. We had one recently. We called it "How a Nice Filipino Girl Learned to Cook Brisket." It's this lovely Filipino woman married to a Jewish guy, and it was her idea that they should start doing Hanukkah. And so she told the story of a Christmas when she makes a really killer brisket. And so she told the story of how she had Christmas one time with her family and his family, and they made brisket and a ham, which is just this fabulous cultural, you know, intersection. And so we really welcome the community getting involved in those waves. We've had so many nice videos, a woman from Indiana talking about pie culture in Indiana and how she grew up with pie everywhere and prizes at the state fair and all of this. And it's just a wonderful way to not only hear from our community members in writing, but to see them and get a feel for their voices and their personalities. And we always try to run a family recipe with those stories as well.
So the words co-opted or incorporated come to mind because you hear these stories and obviously you want to make these recipes. What kind of new cultural affects have you introduced into your family's lives?
We have no time to cook anymore.
I'm thinking of one recipe that I made recently. One of our, actually this is a freelancer, wonderful writer named Nevin Martell, who lives down in the D.C. area where we live, wrote a lovely essay, a memory of going maple sugaring with his dad when he was little in upstate New York. And, you know, he talked about tasting raw maple syrup before it's been boiled off, the sap, and then just boiling it down into maple syrup. And he shared a recipe at the end of this piece for something called Shomur pudding. That's C-H-O-M-E-R. Yeah. Which is actually a Canadian recipe. And from what we understand, it was created by factory workers in Quebec. Well, I had never heard of this, but I love maple syrup. And so this is kind of almost like a biscuit crust. And then you pour maple syrup mixed with cream over it, and you bake it in the oven. And Nevin actually added sliced bourbon peaches to his. So I found sliced bourbon peaches at Whole Foods, and I made this this dessert, and I served it to my kids, and they said it was just the absolute best thing they had ever eaten in their lives. You know, I mean, Italian cooking is what I turn to all the time, but I love discovering recipes like this.
So let's talk about first time versus best time, because does the story have to be the first key lime pie or the first canned soup, or can it just be the first time someone experienced it or the 100th time someone experienced it and that's when it meant something to them?
We find a lot of this. You find a lot of this at holidays. So we did a piece on gefilte fish and someone's mother's favorite, grandmother's favorite gefilte fish recipe. We did a story on Chinese New Year, and people had their favorite. Now, for many of our readers and for us, these foods were new, but they were traditional foods for these families and things that they enjoyed year after year.
This is Michelle. I'm just going to put this out there that the first time doesn't have to be an epiphany. And I think you were asking, is it the first time or the 100th time? And I think it's that the point at which something takes on meaning to you is the point at which you wake up to and it becomes important. I'm thinking in particular of stuffed grape leaves, which I grew up with, lamb stuffed grape leaves. If you eat grape leaves in Damascus, which I have done, they are filled with rice. And my uncle and I sort of made, you know, the family pilgrimage back to Syria in 1993 or 92. And we kept eating these grape leaves. We were like, what are these? They have rice? They're cold? What's going on? They're like Greek. And 100 miles north in Aleppo, poor Aleppo, poor Syria in general. But in Aleppo, they're exactly as we knew them. They're hot. They're stuffed with rice and lamb. They're served in tomato sauce and garlic. But for me, these really, so that was the first time I knew that you could do them differently. But for me, those took on meaning when I go to a Syrian Catholic church. And part of the reason I go there is because there's a lot of cooking involved. And the only connection that my daughter will have to that culture or to that food is through the church, because I don't make a lot of it at home, et cetera. And so I would say the point at which that took on meaning for me was when I watched her when she was 6 years old with her tiny little fingers kind of badly rolling these grape leaves and having all the old sit-daws sitting next to her sort of re-rolling them on the QT when she wasn't watching.
And you can find all this and more on AmericanFoodRoots.com. And what's so amazing too is it's not just written, it's multimedia. There will be videos. There'll be so much more. And if you care as much as these ladies do and I do about our American food roots, please visit the site and contribute and interact. Thank you again for being on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Cheers. We caught up with Frederick Berselius, and Evan Strutinsky after the panel on food and foraging. Frederick is the chef at Aska, a Scandinavian restaurant in North Williamsburg that uses numerous foraged ingredients in his dishes. Evan is a professional forager and writer who is bringing forgotten weeds, roots, mushrooms, and flowers back into the kitchen.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel for HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Here today at the Food Book Fair talking about foraging with two such people that are experts, if you can consider yourself an expert in the foraging field, Evan Strutinsky and Frederick Berzelius. How you doing, guys? I'd love for you to introduce yourself and talk about your attachment to foraging a little bit, whether or not you do it actively or you cook with it or use it actively.
This is Evan Strutinsky, and I happen to be in a position of finding unique ingredients for chefs around New York City and elsewhere. And I fell into this position just by happenstance, and it's kind of met with a trend, and so I continue doing it for a short while longer until I die of exhaustion.
And this is a post-mortem.
That's right. That's right. And so, Frederick.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Frederick Berzelius. Yes. So I got into foraging simply because I work with ingredients all the time and looking for different ingredients or trying to understand the where we are, the landscape that we're in, and working locally. I don't know. I just find foraging ingredients from the area that you're in. It's a good representation of. Well, I want to translate the landscape that we're in the food that we serve at the restaurant, and that's a big reason why we forage. But also, I grew up, you know, surrounded by. Even though I'm from a big city, the capital of Sweden, I still grew up spending a lot of time outdoors. And for me, living in New York for such a long time, it's just a. It's a way of bringing back memories, and it's a way of cooking with, again, memories that I had growing up, finding foraged ingredients.
So where it seems like Frederick had some natural association with foraging and wanted to bring that back into his life, how did you make it a part of your life? You said it was happenstance, it hit a trend, it worked out for that, but you must be excited about it. You must, you know, find some kind of interest in it to be able to still passionately do it.
Well, I was interested before it became a trend. I had an interest in, you know, finding, locating, and consuming some of these ingredients. And it was very enjoyable to try to sort of release some of these things from their cages, from, you know, their reputation as being merely weeds or somehow without a kind of integrity of their own. And I saw some of the ingredients as very capable of holding their own. And so as the foraging trend started, you know, emerged, I wanted to see just how far I could sort of take it, but not in a way that was just like some joke trying to pass off ingredients that shouldn't have been used, but actually because I believed that some of these things were quite tasty and, you know, somewhat forgotten or obscured, belittled. And so from there it grew, and I've actually come to appreciate, I've grown along with the job of picking these things for restaurants. I've gained a greater appreciation of what is both edible and sort of used in a culinary way, and have come to also learn about my place, where I am, this, you know, Atlantic, upper, you know, northeast kind of location, because I'm broadening my own knowledge of what is useful in this way, because there is the demand, and I'm therefore given the it's a great pleasure actually to be able to learn on the job in this way and keep giving unique things. It's quite a thrill to be able to provide a chef, a restaurant, with an ingredient that they have never seen or that's completely new to them, and that invigorates the kitchen. So that's always the greatest pleasure of this job for me.
So this is kind of a two-parter, because Frederick walked down here initially with a handful of woodruff and that you got from Evan. And I know that as part of a syrup that goes into Berliner Weiss. But I don't know it outside of that. So it's really a question about what is harder, actively pursuing those ingredients or changing people's perceptions about them?
No, I mean, I think many of the flavors in wild ingredients are recognizable or often easily approachable as well for any consumer. Characteristics of different greens can be found in you know, I don't want to compare ingredients and say this tastes like that with a different tone. I don't want to say woodruff tastes like vanilla or but there are, as you're eating them, you can somehow associate them to other flavors, even though they have their own distinct ones. So
you know, you talk about these flavor profiles, and I'd like to hear more specifics about, you know, what ingredients you actually forage and, you know, what dishes, you know, Frederick might put them in. I saw a whole bunch of boxes of cresses, of, you know, other weeds. And I actually want to read this list. Leaves, stems, flowers, fungi, weeds. These seem like the offal of, you know, plants or you know, detritus, throwaway. How do you take something like that and make it exciting and pleasant in the dish?
Well, if these things are novel to a chef, to a kitchen, to diners, then they're exciting by default, simply because they're new. I've seen chefs be excited one season because this thing is new to them, and then disparaging the next season because they realize they walk on these things every day on their way to the kitchen when they're crossing the park or something like that. I'm not just selling a product, an ingredient. I'm selling an idea, often, more than anything. So in order to get someone excited about something that may be an odd taste or a new ingredient, is by framing it in a way that appeals. Framing it in a way that, you know, you can associate it with something else to give it a kind of reference, which then kind of diminishes it, really. Or you can, you know, in that, doing it that way is a way to get some chefs who, you know, maybe are a little more conservative, and then some chefs who want the most outsider challenging kind of flavors. Well, then I can frame it in a certain way for them if it's, you know, if that's should. And then, you know, once I get the thing, if it's,
I think they're both. I think a lot of times I mentioned this earlier today, but they wild ingredients often take on like stronger characteristics than, for example, farmed ones. I mean, what we find now or growing wild is very much represents spring to me, even though it's, you know, a few weeks past spring. You know, at our restaurant, we try and work with what's around us, more or less, and knowing, like using what's growing in the wild right now, just often we let the vegetable or herb just represent itself in a very natural way. Often we don't manipulate it too much before we put it on the plate. So now that all these shoots and leaves and greenish end up, you know, or showing up, We often present them as is. They have to... they often fall into maybe a mustard family or an onion family can be cooked in similar ways to more traditional ingredients.
So they're not really foreign at all as far as concepts go. But they seem exclusive in their, I don't know, limited ability or limited accessibility, both, you know, to the chef and maybe as a forager, because I know some of these things are in secret locations and done at special time. I know you roll your eyes a little bit, but that is people's perception of foraging. And is it that or is it not?
If I can say, I just think it's for chefs and restaurants in
whether the ingredients are exclusive or not is not my concern. I am interested in providing good ingredients to chefs. If it's foraged, it's foraged. If it's, you know, otherwise, then that's fine too. And so I feel fortunate to be able to ramble around outside, you know, kind of improvisationally gathering these things. That
I feel like even abundant ingredients can become exclusive because they might not, even though it is a weed, or it can become extremely exclusive to New York City because it's not growing right here in the city. You know, not everyone. You have to know Evan, or you have to know someone who can get the ingredients to you. There are times of year when there are, yes, mushrooms that do not grow, you know, that are more difficult to find, or you have to spend a lot of time researching them or knowing where to go pick them. Other times, it's just a matter of time and knowing what to look for. Again, you're paying for someone else's knowledge, basically.
Well, I want to talk about that knowledge for a second, because we were just commenting about doppelgangers. The idea of, you know, foraging is this foreign concept that people are afraid of doing it because they don't know what these things are. But they're very common things. How do you educate yourself to know what these are and not be harmed by picking the wrong thing?
Well, first, I'd like to say that I encourage the notion that these things are incredibly dangerous and should be avoided, simply so that there are more for me to pick. I would never say to the general public that, in fact, all of these things are very common and are easy to identify as your own children are for you. So I would never say that on the radio. But I'm conservative in my approach, and I have a lot of experience in identifying plants and mushrooms, and I have many seasons doing it. The repetition helps kind of solidify things, and I tack on a few new ingredients every year, and plenty of things I don't know, plants and fungus, and but then I try to, you know, learn a few more, and so I'm getting to learn as I go as well. I just happen to be perhaps ahead of the curve, and one has to be cautious. There are plenty of things out there that are that will not only give you gastrointestinal distress, but can do you greater harm, like turn your liver to jelly. But also, since we live in a kind of, we're a little phobic regarding mushrooms especially. I think maybe we should relax that stance a bit and realize that there's plenty of good stuff out there, and it's not all that scary. And if we just took a little time to, you know, try to educate ourselves, we'd find that, in fact, we'd have some, you know, pleasure ahead of us in terms of what's on the plate that we get ourselves.
So let's talk about local versus Maine, because I know, Evan, a lot of your stuff comes from, you know, further north. What can you get in New York? What would you encourage a beginning forager to look at? You know, like, what is the beginner weed or beginner forage good in New York within, you know, 100-block radius that, you know, I know purslane was big. What else is there?
Nettles. Yeah, some of the ingredients that are easily had are nettles, like Freddie said. Stinging nettles, very tasty and very prolific. Knotweed is another one. It is an invasive species that was introduced by, supposedly anyway, by Frederick Law Olmsted in Central Park, and now is everywhere, and is very tasty and tastes a little like rhubarb, and controlling it would eating it would be a very good way of controlling it. Garlic mustard is another one, invasive species that's very tasty, and it's a spring green, tastes as the name implies, like garlic and mustard. What other things are there? Field mustard is Brassica rapa. It tastes, it's like broccoli rabe, and it grows everywhere, and it's so tasty, and it's better than broccoli rabe. It's both sweet and bitter. It's fantastic. The root is unbelievably good and large, and you can find it in such quantity in the spring, that, you know, it's something that should be definitely used everywhere. You know, it should be a staple. And it's sort of sinful that it's not used in the, at least in the Northeast, in a, you know, in a real significant way. Dandelions, fantastic. You know, don't give me the English lawn. You know, long live dandelions, the common weed, the common scourge of lawn people who like lawns. They're fantastic for you, and the root is great, really good and bitter, great with bacon in the spring. Nothing else I'd rather have. It actually is eating these things, you know, in the place, getting them yourself and eating them, is something that I look forward to, whether the species is invasive or whether it's, you know, native. Every year, spring, summer, fall, I look forward to these things because I've cultivated this, you know, sense of place through consuming place.
Are some of these things you forage for intentionally planted and just got forgotten? Are they, you know, wild, like you say, and just went rampant? Why are they there, and why have they been overlooked for so long?
I mean, I know they're, I mean, they're native species of plants growing next to obviously tons of European species of plants. I know many, I mean, ingredients, many, some of the ingredients that we use have been brought here by settlers or people who wanted a little bit of their native land to come to the New World. And many of those species, just, you know, the climate is different and maybe more, even more suitable for some of these plants, and they're just taking over. And that's same with some animals. For me, it's a good thing sometimes. Invasive species, when they take over and kill other plants, it's not always a good thing. But it's interesting to find other species here that have been around for since forever, that are only grown. I guess the redbud tree is native to America. Like some amaranth species are native to
cattail.
There are tons of species that came from here, and now they might be in Europe. But yes, often this it is the other way around.
This is tangential to the conversation, but I think somewhat related anyway. A friend alerted me to a couple of russet apple trees that were on the edge of someone's property. I didn't know whose property. No one seemed to be home. The apples looked great. I climbed the tree. I was shaking them down. The owners returned. And they sat maybe somewhat fearful in their driveway, in their car still, watching me shake apples, continue to shake apples down from their tree and put them in a bag. The apples were very delicious. They were perfectly ripe. And when one of them eventually rolled down the window tentatively and asked me what the hell I was doing there, I told them, and they said, go right on doing it. We wouldn't eat those apples. And it turns out that they get their apples from the store that's right down the road, apples that are shipped from Washington State. So every year I return to those trees just to shame them.
I have a similar story. Someone who had amazing grapes in his backyard, but in his kitchen he had a big bowl of store-bought grapes. You can eat the grapes that are growing on the tree outside my window. I mean, it's funny. People are often scared of what's not in the grocery aisles. I think that's changing, though. I think the perception of food and localism is coming back to something what it might have been before.
I want to talk about property really quick. And I mean, you know, where these things grow and where you go to get them. Because I want to attach that back to what Freddie said, and I'm going to call you Freddie now, about serving something directly on, you know, a sod of sorrel. Why not actually go to the space where these things are growing and close that cycle and serve your food where these foods are foraged? Or is that not the point?
I mean, no one... It's funny. Often restaurants, you would get your ingredients in a little plastic bag, and they're perfectly washed and cleaned, and then you move away from that, and you start to find your own ingredients or getting them from someone who picked them, and it can be from a farmer, it can be from a forager, and they show up, and they're sandy and dirty, and often these greens grow perfectly fine and are in edible state as they grow. And I mean, walking around in the woods picking plants, I eat tons of greens not washed in the woods when I do. It's just snacking along as you go. And it would be fun just to if you could, you know, put a big duck or a chicken on just straight on the field and dig around. But yeah, I still love the idea of a little park where everything you walk on is edible. It's like swimming in a pool of...
I like the idea very much, actually. It's hard to think of some of the places that I see that I like actually functioning as a restaurant that gives... you know, actually sustains you financially or something. But I was on some frozen lake this winter ice fishing with my friends Sergey and Sam Richman, and we saw this little kind of forgotten cottage on one of the points that jut out into the lake. And we all kind of hatched this plan of it being a sauna and a little restaurant where, you know, we get the mushrooms that grow right there, the fish that are right there, and, you know, and there wouldn't be a big menu. It would just be this is all, you know, you come for this. Just the way I would go to this one stall in Istanbul where I wanted fish fried with wedges of onion. And that's it. That's the meal. You sit down, if this is what you want, you sit down, you're in the market, you pass by, you eat this, and then you're gone. And I loved that place. I would go, you know, once a week to do this and eat nothing else but that. So, but that's in a city, in this, you know, northern outpost on a desolate lake in Maine. You know, it's a great fantasy, but a challenging reality.
Thanks for listening to this special program. Visit our website to hear our 30-plus weekly podcasts and learn about membership programs. HRN is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.